Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, so much going on, and fortunately, we say global truth transit, may everyone be informed and participatory. So, more than perfectly, we welcome Daisy Gedyon, recently returned from The Hague, indefatigable reporter, filmmaker, joining us at her midnight with espresso in hand. Thank you so much that we honor all the independent journalists doing the real work that mainstream is not in regard to the ongoing carnage in the West Bank, Gaza, everywhere past and present that humans have been cruelly ripped from the land that they love. Her website is Daisy, D-A-I-Z-Y, Gedyon, G-E-D-E-O-N.com. And she is award-winning filmmaker and journalist, founder of Free and Fair Lebanon Foundation, board member of World Humanitarian Drive, many things, awarded British Regal Award, awarded 100 Successful Women in Business in 2022, awarded Most Influential Women Leaders. Welcome, Daisy.
What a beautiful intro. Thank you very much. You've humbled me.
Well, thank you so much. I follow you on Instagram. Instagram is where it's at, you know, and I post many things from Instagram to Facebook, and some of them disappear. You know, I think you more than many, but we all have some picture that's like, I think it's recently, it's the picture of the dead baby in his mother's arms still holding a chocolate bar. And it's like, sink to our knees. You started off as a sports writer. That's in Australia. That's good, because a lot of what passes for patriotism is really like people supporting a sports team, for goodness sake. But also your films that I will look up and happily watch and keep this going. Lebanon Imprisoned Splendor, starring Omar Sharif in 1996. Many things. Feel free to bring up anything. 2021, you were presented with the Movie That Matters Award at a Better World Fund gala event for your documentary Enough, Lebanon's Darkest Hour. So you're in Beirut right now, yeah?
Yes. And I'm actually sitting in a darkened lounge room because, as many of you might know, we have an energy problem in Beirut. The power goes and comes at its own will. There isn't 24-hour electricity here. But fortunately, the internet is still working. I have that on a UPS, so I keep that going.
Yes, that's great. And then so much, you know, of what's been posted. You know, I also follow you, of course, and Wizard Bissan, oh my goodness, you know, who says, you know, something you don't know is happening right now. Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunus is being carpet bombed. Tens of thousands of people are moving randomly with nowhere to go. It's the end of the world. I've never seen anything like this. Right, we wouldn't know but for you. I mean, it's not, no mainstream's carrying it. So thank you. That's such a crucial dynamic.
Thank
and you.
You
are just
thank you right. for sharing. Thank you for reading, for watching, for being engaged, and to millions of people around the world who are doing that, because without that force of energy around the world, the people, you know, taking an interest, they would have gotten away with this, and they would be, you know, there would be more than nearly 30,000 now dead. It would be a larger number than that, and it would have all been, you know, undertaken, and an atrocity that we have never witnessed. I have never witnessed in my lifetime. I'm a history buff, and I know there have been many genocides around the world in history. But to be living through one is quite traumatic. And I'm sure I'm traumatized, but I'm traumatized in a way that it forces me to act. I'm, you know, emotionally exhausted by it, but I feel like I have to keep going on. And every time I see and hear and read I just drives me to continue to get as much information out to as many people as possible. And I react differently. I don't shut down. I know I've had friends and people who've written to me saying they can't see anymore, but we have to. If we stop, they'll get away with it. And it won't just happen to the Palestinians. This will happen to others. And that's my real fear. What drives me is that it's not going to end there, that we have to make this the last time it ever happens, because it can't and shouldn't happen to anyone and any other people anywhere else in the world.
Right. So you've done the brilliant alchemy, which is for those who can, and you can, you know, to transform trauma into my dangerous, beautiful assignment. You're working it, you know, you're working it. And I don't know if you follow, you probably do, Motaz Azaita.
My goodness. Incredible man.
And Bissan, of course, but they're all, you know, still alive. Is we check our feeds and, you know, or this might be my last, or like, whew. And
that's
all honor
scary.
To them, because
that's scary, that if anything happens to either one of them. I mean, obviously we've become more attached to them because they're speaking English, you know, and we can relate to them and we feel them. But if anything happens to them, it would just be horrendous, you know.
Well, it's leaving these. Sorry.
It's you know.
It's weaving these strands of intimacy. You know, following Bissan, I mean, so many of us, and there's thousands who follow her, but we feel intimate with her and her fate, like, oh my goodness. And the same with Motaz and many, many, many others, like, you know, and send prayers of protection that all harm may be deflected back to its source. But yes, as you say, the danger, the cynical thing that that so much of the reality police is counting on is that, well, people will just, you know, move on. They will just forget this. And it's like, no. I can't stand going anywhere where Gaza is not mentioned. I can't, you know, out to a dinner. It's like, what's the... And you're very on that. So you were one of the 14 people allowed into The Hague, yeah.
Yeah, I was determined. I hadn't flown all the way over there to miss out. I missed out on the first day by 2 spots because they only allow 14. And we got there at 5:15 and, you know, we were number 16 and 17. So we were determined to get in the next day. So we you know, I actually went to sleep at 12:45 a.m., and woke up at 1:30 a.m. So I had 45 minutes sleep and I was like, I was a buzz. I was, had a quick shower, got changed, rugged up, and we went and we were the first people there. And it's remarkable because, you know, within 10 minutes, you know, another 5 people had arrived. And by 3:30, we were up to 15, 16. And then more people started coming and we just said, you know, you see ya, like you've got no chance. But luckily we went early and that was a determination of wanting to get in and bear witness, being in that room. And especially I'm glad I was there for the Israeli, submissions, because I knew what the South Africans were going to say, but I really was impressed with their delivery and I watched it. And if I couldn't actually get in, so I was watching it on the UN channel and I was very impressed, but I was so glad to bear witness to the lies. I just was shocked at that the lies that they continued from the very beginning, from October 7, they just repeated everything, even though 90% of the information and the examples that they gave, the testimony they gave, had been debunked. I was shocked and I was looking at the judges thinking, I mean, how can you sit there? I pray that you've actually been watching the news and seeing this. I mean, I'm sure they have, but, you know, I don't know how they looked upon those phenomenal, like, in these, they had the most distinguished lawyers representing them, obviously with their British barristers making submissions. But I just wondered what was going through the minds of those judges and being able to watch them, because the backs of the Israelis were to us and the faces of the judges, we could see the faces. So it was very interesting. And I was just, it's the courtroom is a showroom, it's a stage. And my fear was, the performance, I've seen many cases in the performance, it should never outweigh the facts, the evidence. But sometimes some people can be persuaded by a very powerful performance. And the last two deliveries on the Israeli side made me shiver a little bit because they were very good. But if you believe them, that's if you believe them, So, but it goes back to the facts, and that's what we're hoping, that these 17 judges that were on the bench just referred to, the facts presented so well by the South Africans, incredible evidence, well put, well structured, irrefutable. It's, they tried as you would, as I said, a court case, the other side is always there to dismiss the non- and debates, you try and dismiss the evidence presented, but they can't dismiss it. If there isn't a positive outcome from this hearing, it's politics then, and that's not justice. That they haven't applied the law. Politics has interfered, and that is a complete failure of the justice system, and this the highest court in the world. That would be a tragedy of justice.
Right. Politics and bribery, many say. So we look at that. And so the judges are deliberating now. And I love in Arabic fairy tales, one of the openings is "it was and it was not." So do you have a necessary miracle that you would like to put before our imaginative, dedicated listenership of what you would like to have happen?
Absolutely. My wish is that justice prevails. The facts are absorbed and respected, and that these judges remember why they were appointed to this court, why it was created, and they don't allow personal, political, or bribery to interfere. I want to see justice done, and that is that they implement the recommendations of the South African, country, of South Africa, the submissions of the South African party, and that we have not only a ceasefire, but real punishment implemented against the state of Israel. Because without punishment, without a sense of suffering, other nations and other people, and there are a lot of unfortunately, incorrigible people in the world who look upon this and say, if they get away with it, I can get away with it. And so there has to be a just punishment to fit the crime. So that is my wish, because we in the world today have lost faith. And if this is another incident of crushing our faith in the final institution that can make an impact, have an impact, I'm not sure what we, what we people are going to do. Who do we turn to? This is the question, the dilemma that we face right now, and that's what the court must consider, is that what will people do? Where does our faith in humanity and in the institutions that have been created more than 70 years ago to protect against these sort of acts, Where is that? I think if that happens, there has to be a dismantling of the United Nations. There has to be an overthrow, and there has to be a realignment of some new structure, because the United Nations Security Council, you know, there's five countries that control the Security Council, and their veto power is an abomination to justice, a complete abomination.
With the veto power.
That's right. Yes. That's just ridiculous. Honestly, that is just ridiculous, because that it just comes back to my personal interests, whatever their personal interests are. And it's been shown time and again. And it just defies everything that United Nations was created for.
So we're looking at really big things before us all, the nature of community and human community, as opposed to the toxic mimic, which is a cult. A Jewish ally I hosted on the radio last month had written a powerful essay on the Israeli government is a cult, right? And really laid it out. And it's like, right, a community, ideally, you know, is dedicated to collective well-being of everybody. It's a freedom. It's a dream. It's a thing. A cult is an imprisoning thing, but it hoovers people, you know. And so you're saying, you know, is the International Court for Justice, is it actual, or is it controlled by a cult? You know, I mean, this is what we're kind of putting on the table. So many things. And then just, you know, again, the force of you and so many, and more now, listening to you now more, which is, no, we will not let this disappear. This is not going away. There was a, you know, huge global outpouring on Saturday, on January 13th, including here in Washington, D.C., probably 70,000 people. Nowhere mentioned in the front section of the Washington Post. You'd think 70,000 people outside the White House and in the Freedom Plaza would bear a mention. There was an article in Section B, the local metro section, which, you know, was annoying and terrible, and then sort of okay. They talked to many Palestinian people there who told their stories, and it's like, okay. But again, you know, what you're doing and your allies are doing and what we all aspire to support, you know, let every tyranny be an incentive to experiment for greater freedom. And that's part of what you're doing with you are indefatigable, Daisy. I mean, you put out so many missives and in the course of a day. I'm like, whoa, okay, I want to be like Daisy when I grow up. That's really good. It's really powerfully dedicated. And there are so many things that we want to be aware of. And there are good narrators out there, not mainstream, but it's slowly infiltrating. Piers Morgan, right? Piers Morgan, who is conniption fit inducing. And I used to joke that, like, well, just sentence Hamas to interminable interviews with Piers Morgan. That'll show them, right? But Piers Morgan just came out going, I think Israel's gone too far. And it's like, well, it's like a tarot card. It's like, even Piers Morgan said, I think it's gone too far. What?
Yeah. He's got a conscience. Like, you know, watching Blinken, I posted on Blinken too. I actually felt like, I honestly feel that the Western powers had no idea that Israel was this evil. And they have, I've mentioned it in many of my captions, that they let the genie out of the bottle and they don't know how the hell they're going to get it back in. They just never believed that it would get this bad. And you know, I mean, Biden now hasn't talked to Netanyahu in 3 weeks, apparently, and he, you know, because Netanyahu's not listening to him. And Netanyahu's even said, you know, I was watching a speech now just recently, like a couple of hours ago, where he's trying to say to, you know, our friends, the Americans, you know, you've got to understand that we basically have to do this. It can't end until it ends, kind of thing, and trying to persuade Biden through the media to... I think there's a real rift happening right now, and they don't understand how they're going to get him back in, but they're caught. See, this is the thing. these Western powers that have stood behind, you know, Israel from the UK, the French have pulled right back. Macron is like he had enough. Like in his BBC interview in December, I think it was early December, was that was it. You know, when he first called for a ceasefire, I think they're really out of the little cabal because they can't deal with this. They're not accepting it anymore. But the UK, even Australia, who I'm utterly disgusted with, and Germany and the EU are still, you know, towing the line, because I think it's like they're in too deep now, the US, but they're going to just get deeper. They're going to get deeper into this. And, you know, with South Africa now writing up charges to take, you know, charge America with genocide as well and war crimes, you know, this is a real consideration. There is real concern there. So, you know, I think the reality of what the governments, these administrations are facing is how do we get out of this now, you know? And I don't know, you know, they just have to stop, but they also want to save face. You know, they've encouraged this. They're still signing bills, sending weapons. This is just, you know, I just don't understand how they can continue to do this. You know, there's many levers that they can pull in politics and they're not pulling them. It's, I don't know, how powerful right. that the Jewish lobby is, the Zionist lobby is. It's incredible. I don't know what evidence they have. You know, there was a report that I posted a couple of weeks ago, or even last week. I think it was Archbishop Vanya, I think he's Italian, who was saying that it's all tied back to the Mossad and Jeffrey Epstein, and they have evidence. Oh, yeah. You know, the Mossad sets people up, and I don't know what they've got on Biden or what they've got on others, but it's like
they definitely have something. Well, it's been put forward on RFK Jr., who's like rah rah genocide. No, and you know, even in interviews, Crystal Ball said, you know, well, what do you think about the water and the electricity being cut off? And RFK Jr. said, I don't think that's true. And it's like, and then they said, you know, he did hang out with Jeffrey Epstein and his wife was tight with his consort, Ghislaine, and what. But yes, in America, I mean, as you know, I mean, academics are losing their jobs and Facebook's coming down on posting of truth. And, you know, it's a tight tyranny. But I want to go back to the metaphor that you offered, the genie's out of the bottle. So I'm going to start rereading the 1001 Nights, because it's like there is a way to get the genie back in the bottle. I can't remember if it's Aladdin or whatever, but you know, it says, I bet you can't. I bet you're not that powerful. I bet you can't fit back in the bottle. And it's like, I'll show you, and then put the stopper back in. I think that's a good image just for us to animate, going, all right, trick the genie back into the bottle, put the stopper on. So, you know, everything. But yes, and, you know, we do want everything. You know, the Israeli flags planted along the beach, the interviews with Israeli soldiers going, this beach is so lovely, it shouldn't belong to the Palestinians. We're going to build condos, right? And then the plans for development, it's like, no, absolutely not. You know, that's their ocean and all the things we can do. So then the disarray in Israel, which you also had a point on, economically, socially imploding. Biden is more popular in Israel than Bibi because he did go over there and grieve with the families of the hostages. And they're like, we like you more than Bibi. Bibi doesn't know how to grieve. His grief has been colonized to not be able to extend because he's so good at grieving about everything but this most crucial thing. And I was hoping and visualizing and intending way back that, you know, Biden, it's a Hail Mary pass, but Biden had earned enough trust in Israel to address the Knesset, because, you know, the Bibi addressed our right-wing cuckoo people in the Congress to address the Knesset and to speak sanity about safety. It's like, come on, Pope Francis, call up Joe, speak to his Catholic heart. You know, but it's awfully long since then. Mm. I don't know what will happen. Do you think, you know, and so many people are just furious with Biden, and that was the major sign. Granted, it was the code pink part of the rally on Saturday that was like, abandon Biden. It's like, that's your strongest sign, really? Well, okay, you know, maybe one sign, but that was their primary message. And it's like, I'm not sure that's the most useful magic at the moment. But can you imagine any, even, I mean, he's losing every support. Can you imagine any role for him to play? Can you imagine him addressing the Knesset? Is that plausible?
I don't think he has to address the Knesset. I think it's a directive. He just needs to have the balls to say, that's it, we're cutting you off. Because without the money, without the aid, without the weapons, Israel is going to be, you know, Israel's going to run out of steam. And this is, you know, the UK will take the lead from America. But the, the Knesset, it won't have any difference, because Netanyahu's probably out of the cabinet. Netanyahu might be the tamest out of the crazies that are in the cabinet. I mean, he has selected 17. He's had to create a coalition made up of 17 of the most right-wing parties in Israel for him to have formed that government. He wasn't going to become prime minister. He had to do deals with the worst of the worst, promise them ministries and title, and now they're running free. They're running the country, and it's mind-boggling. So I don't think he'll have any impact, because these people are worse than Netanyahu. And it comes back, this all is a real important point, that people need to think about who they're voting into power, and why we need to have better people stand up and want to get into politics. I know everyone says politics is a dirty game.
Oh, but no, we got to play.
If we don't play, you know, we're leaving it to the worst, the scum of the earth, and they love to play in that, because it's the most powerful, you know, arena. So we need more people to stand up, and this is, you know, a sign and a message to the Israelis, but also to the Americans. But my fear next year is, in America, you know, neither candidate is good for America or for the world. Like, you know, we're looking at a Trump-Biden race here again, and that is shocking. I can't believe in a country of over 300 million people, there is not one or two decent people who will run as president. I mean, I don't think you even need money right now to run a campaign. The only problem you would have is getting media publicity, because the mainstream media wouldn't put you on there. But if you were a decent person, you know, people would turn to you and support you.
Right. No, it's true. And yet AIPAC has an iron fist around democracy in America, and they're already launching millions to defeat the SANE, the Squad, the wonderful women in Congress, the things that, you know, so there's a fear thing. But this is where we're, you know, stand up. You know, this is stronger democracy. Absolutely. Our guest, who was, can I keep you for the second half, the half hour after this break, you with your espresso in Beirut?
Yeah, sure. I'm wide awake.
Oh, thank you. What's another half hour with an espresso? Because there's so many things to do. So our super wonderful guest is Daisy Gedeon. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Perfectly.
Okay, good. She's reporting to us. She's indefatigable. Follow her on Instagram, which seems to be the most reliable source at the moment for everything. And we're going to play as our break music just Leve Palestina, because it's such a rousing, beautiful song written in the 70s by a Palestinian in Sweden. But it's got such woof to it. So we'll be right back after Leve Palestina.
Leve, leve, leve Palestina. Leve, leve, leve Palestina. Leve Palestina, o grossa sionisten. Leve Palestina, o grossa sionisten.
Och vi har rullat jorden.
Och vi har rullat jorden.
Och vi har skördat vetet.
Och vi har skördat vetet.
Vi har plockat citronerna.
Vi har plockat citronerna
och pressat oliverna.
Och pressat oliverna.
Och hela världen känner till vår jord.
Och hela världen känner till vår jord. Leve, leve, leve Palestina. Leve, leve, leve Palestina. Leve Palestina och grossa sionismen. Leve Palestina och rossa sionisten.
Och vi har kastat stenar på.
Och vi har kastat stenar på.
Soldater och poliser.
Soldater och poliser.
Och vi har skjutit raketer.
Och vi har skjutit raketer.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. And our guest this hour from Beirut with her espresso in hand, because it's past midnight there, is Daisy Gedeon, whom I'm delighted to follow on Instagram and delighted to welcome here to all of us, in case you haven't known about her. She's part of the team, really, democratic reporting. Again, wherever there's tyranny, may there be inventiveness. And her posting is indefatigable. Really, just so impressive. Here we are with many, many questions. Because part of, to be a participatory global citizen, you know, no one minds being asked, did you know, unless we ask it in a snarky way, did you know about this? Oh, no, I didn't. And so I view you as part of the team of with the people we fill up our backpacks with. Did you know about this? Did you know about the global strike from the 21st to the 28th in January? Tell us more about that and how what that would look like and how we can participate in the global strike from January 21st to the 28th.
I will. I just want to say something about the posts because, you know, the content that I try to put out, I try to do it in a very specific way because I'm curating so much content, and what my purpose is to make sure that people get a full view of what's happening around the world and from every angle, because I want people to be informed, well informed, educated historically, currently, politically, socially. There's so many angles, and that's why I have increased the number of posts, because there is so much that people need to know about, and different audiences and people will, you know, relate to different stories. But my purpose is that you can find a range of content that will enrich your understanding so that you can be more empowered and more confident when you stand and argue or, you know, have a conversation. Because education empowers us, the knowledge that we have gives us more resilience to keep fighting. And so I do that on purpose. And, you know, sometimes there's more than others, but lately there's just been much more. And because it's such an important moment at the moment with the ICJ and giving more people enthusiasm to keep fighting. So I just wanted to note that. And in relation to the Global Strike Week, you know, I got to tell you, early in December, I was thinking, God, how do we have an impact? How do we have an impact? You know, and this idea came that we should have a global strike day where everyone doesn't go to school, doesn't go to work, doesn't go to everything. And I swear to God, it's like this collective consciousness. And within a few days, someone, announced the first strikes that we started having later in December or a week or so later. And it was like, fantastic, brilliant, you know, and, you know, I was all in for it. And then I swear to God, a few days before the global strike, Bissan announced, I was thinking it's got to go bigger. It's got to go bigger. And, you know, we need to do it for a week to have much more of an impact on the economy. And so it's so exciting. So when that came out, you know, yesterday that this was happening, I was so on board with it. And so the whole purpose of it is to hit these countries, these administrations where it hurts, because as we've seen with the Houthis and Yemen impacting the shipping, it's impacting them so badly, it's affecting their economies so badly, or our economies so badly, that they've had to launch raids and bombard Yemen because it's having a huge impact. And above human life, they rate their economy. It's all about money. So this global strike week is about impacting the economies in each of these countries, because businesses will be impacted, schools, you know, government institutions, transportation. If we're able to do this, like, people just stop, take a week off, just stay home, don't go to cafes. I know we're going to affect local businesses. I know businesses that are not involved and support Palestine are going to be impacted, but they should be enthusiastic about this too and do it themselves. They should close. They should close for a week as a sign of protest, because we need to stop the money flowing into the economy, flowing back to the banks, flowing back to the governments, because that's where it will really hurt them and say these people, our people, are actually really serious. And so I really want to encourage people to take it seriously. I know people will fear that they'll lose their jobs, but, you know, just do this. This is more important. We can always get another job. There will always be that requirement. Look what happened in COVID. Everyone, you know, so many people were laid off, but then the economy picked up again and everyone got jobs back. So, you know, this is more important. We are the guardians of humanity at this time in history. This is our time to make a difference. And we only get this chance now. And so I really encourage people and implore people to take that decision. I'm not going to stop, because it's very important for me and my team to keep getting everything out as much as we can. But we're working on a mission. We're basically an NGO. We don't make any money. We are paying to do this. We are paying to do this service for humanity. So this is part of us serving humanity and serving this cause to ensure that we get the information out. But everyone who's not involved in this area, unless you're involved in pushing the cause and you know, disseminating information, then you have a real duty to support this global strike week.
And we distill a working principle to put on our work tables, because anything anywhere is everywhere. I mean, the earth is bombarded. Everything, which is to make terrible things too expensive. It's like that's what you're saying. Make terrible things too expensive. You know, that pipeline, that thing. And it might be, to our listeners, more plausible. I don't want to water down anything that you said, but to distill, to say, you know, if you must go to your work, you know, then make it a mission. I mean, make it a mission, and make it a mission to put out information wherever you are. Sure. You know, when you're buying, you're not buying a coffee. That's easy to not do. But when you're whatever you're doing, going, did you know about this thing? Did you know about this? Did you know about, you know, from days after Israelis forces withdraw, whole families executed point blank. Did you know about this thing? You know, all of this, you know, and. That you post, that is so important, because it weaves kinship. You know, you posted, you know, the father Kalef returning to find his family in pieces. You know, one daughter survived. They said this was the safe zone. We went to the safe zone, and just my own, you know, dream the news groups that convene every now and then. But way back, there was a Washington Post story about this little baby, Anas Esbeta, and his parents hadn't been able to visit him in the intensive care unit. He was born August 16th in 2023 in Gaza. And then finally they could visit him, but the hospital was being bombed, you know, and they pulled him out of the ICU, and they said they could, you know, the doctor said, we could take him to Egypt, but you can't go with him. And they're like, oh, no, we can't be separated again. We will stay in the south where they said it was safe. Mm. We will live together or die together. It's like, oh, no, this was the first part, his fate was a big story in the Washington Post, like, oh, but I can't find out what happened to him, right? Where is Anas Esbeta? Did his family survive the bombing? We don't know. But just weaving, like, there's that one little baby that stands for so many. Where is the little guy? You know, and may he grow up to be a great leader, whatever that is. But we can't find out the fate of individuals now, can we?
No. You know, until there is a ceasefire, until, you know, you are able to, you know, take stock and review and find the dead people under the rubble and, you know, and you know, inquire. Nothing, you know, there's so many people, there's so many children that have been kidnapped. The other, yesterday, I think there was a story on the woman I think it was last week, you know, this man whose daughter was taken from him and he doesn't know anything about her. Like, what's happened to these people? What's happened to these children? Why are they taking them? And, you know, the most, I'm going to do a report on this one, on, you know, what's shocking to me this week that's come out is them digging up the graves and stealing the bodies, exhuming the bodies. I mean, why are they doing that? And like, to, you know, the West Bank bombing and the attack on the Abu Shalal, and then taking the bodies of the people in the car. Why are they doing that? It's really bizarre. Like, you know, it goes back to this, you know, the fact that, you know, Israel has the biggest organ, you know, transplant or organ harvesting whatever institute operation in the world, and as well as the skin bank. Like, they take skin of Palestinians to transplant them onto, you know, their people. There is this immorality happening, and we're not seeing the full depth of their immorality, but we're sniffing hints of it, and it's scary. It's scary. These people it's beyond, you know, what we would ever imagine. I'm just, there's so many stories that have been exposed now, which is really good that we really know who they are or what we're dealing with. But it's mind-boggling, honestly.
Right.
Sorry, there's a dog sitting out the door. I hope it's not interfering.
No. Oh, no. That. What did you say? Who's that?
There's a dog barking outside in the night.
Oh, okay. No, yay, dogs. We're doing it for dogs too. I took my dogs down to the Palestinian march, going, okay, it's for dogs and creatures and all the cats being excavated and everything, and all the humans and the babies and the Palestinians rescuing the kitties and come on, there's got to be something that moves everyone. Like, oh, phew. Right, so yeah, the dog barking is perfectly fine, although we can't hear him. But we send you good luck, dog in Beirut. And then, you know, for everybody to know, again, you know, another thing that you posted, 1.9 million Palestinians are displaced, right? And there's no sanitation. And then there was a UN doctor saying all wounds are infected. Right, all people who are wounded, those are all infected, which is a horrific sepsis death, slow, terrible thing. You know, did you know that? Did you know that thing? And then something, you know, and then another thing that you posted. Did you know that Israelis are holding 6,000 Palestinians detained since October 7th, and 8,600 Palestinians, you know, held, you know, accumulated before that, and, you know, 3,200 held without charge, right? And And so some things we want to address and keep addressing and keep following Daisy and Motaz and all of the reliable links and sift through. No one narrative, many narratives blended all together, but everybody find out for yourselves what's going on. Mm. So you can go, did you know, and what can we do? The latest horror, and one could say that every 10 minutes, you know, is, you know, you had the... the urgent call for academic solidarity. Here's something we can do. The University of Palestine in Gaza was just destroyed by 315 Israeli mines. And it's like, oh, just so urgent call for academic solidarity, which, again, it's dodgy in this country, right? But it's, you know, if you've lost your academic job, might as well just, you know, head for the the streets and also the voting booths and the megaphone and all of those things. So... So just to honor that, the University of Palestine, you know, what just happened to the University of Palestine?
It just got obliterated, like in seconds. You know, they do it and they laugh. It's just we've seen the videos of them blowing up other buildings, you know, residential blocks and mosques and whatever, but why, you know, I don't understand what more the US administration or the United Kingdom or anyone needs to see. They're seeing all of it, I hope all their staffers are informing them, but why? I mean, what does that have to do with eliminating Hamas, you know? And the fact, one of the other stories was, you know, this idea that, you know, Israel's winning the war. They're not. Hamas is still out there and they're still fighting back. And what have you achieved in more than 3 months and killing nearly 30,000 people and displacing 1.9 million and annihilating it? But you see, this is the thing, when you think about it, it was never to annihilate Hamas.
Right.
That's just, you know, that's the narrative, the rhetoric. They want to feed us. It was to eliminate the Palestinians. It was to take over, to annex Gaza, the Gaza Strip. And now they've started in the West Bank with bombardments in the West Bank and more, you know, atrocities, pulling troops out of, you know, northern Gaza to move them into other areas. You know, they're getting ready for Lebanon. I mean, you know, there's a real movement for them to come in and move into Lebanon and bomb Lebanon. You know, the threats against Lebanon are very serious. You know, there's tremendous tension in the country here, and there's a lot of political voices too, from the UN Secretary General to French politicians to, you know, so many. Even the EU says, you know, we can't let it expand into Lebanon. You know, This is what we're facing, and this is one of the first reports I put out, because I did an analysis on it, a point of view, like within a few weeks of this all starting, was, you know, I said that there's no way they can beat Hamas, because Hamas and Hezbollah are, you know, they're born in these, you know, they're used to the alleyways and the tunnels and the forests and the... They're like the Taliban and the Mujahideen, you know. They beat Russia. Russia was there for 10 years in Afghanistan and they had to leave. They were left with their tails between their legs, and America was in there for 20 years and left, you know, last year embarrassed after trying to defeat the Taliban. You're not fighting with the same motivation. I mean, not the Hezbollah is, you know, running around the streets of Lebanon or anything like that. It's very discreet in how they operate. You don't really know who they are, but they're very, you know, there's a big force of them. I know there's, you know, they're a big militia, and they're very sophisticated. They beat the Israelis in 2006, you know, and Israel's got an air, land and sea might, and they tried to come in and you know, in a land invasion, the Israelis, but they had to leave. You know, they couldn't beat them on the ground once they got into the mountains, because Lebanon's a very mountainous country with lots of, you know, greenery, and they don't know the terrain, you know. So this was just a furphy. It was just a complete lie. And even the president, President Macron, I think before Christmas, he was in Dubai at the climate summit, and he said, you know, does anyone in this room believe that Israel can beat Hamas? Put your hand up. No one put their hand up. Right. He said, yeah, it'll take 10 years if they're lucky, and if they beat them, they're not going to beat them. So we need another solution. This is what we're facing right now.
And just even on a simple level, whenever I've had occasion to talk to warmongers, can always get them to the thing where they go, oh, that's right, the only solution to terrorism is a wonderful life for all children. That's it. And they go, yeah, that's actually true. So just putting that on the table, but back to many things. There's so much. But so is Russia funding Hezbollah?
No, Iran funds Hezbollah.
Right, yeah, put that to one side. Then never mind that. And then just back to Yemen, right? And that's the big contrast has been, you know, commented on, going, oh, care more about the economy than people's lives, because Yemen has said, you know, we will stop this pretty clever, stopping all trade, once there's a ceasefire. Right. And, yeah. In the fairy tale world of where we imagine, you know, we go, Biden would go, well played, Yemen. Well played, yeah. Yemen. I see that you have a moral position, you know, and all we have to do is stop killing everything, stop killing all life, stop, you know, this carnage, and you will stop that. Fair enough. Well played, right? Now that would be the mirror world, right? That's the sensible thing, because that's really what they're saying, you know. And so, yes, yeah, and so there is, you know, Bernie.
Instead, they bombed them 150 times. Sorry.
Yeah. No, what did you say?
Instead, they've bombed them 150 times now.
Yeah.
The last count. Yeah.
Which is a crazy dangerous time. It's a tinderbox. It's just insane. You know that, right? And then it all comes back to tyranny must have an enemy, even if it must create it. Right at the beginning, but really back in the 80s, I was informed, you know, by people who knew about such things, going, did you know that the Israeli government created Hamas? I'm like, no. They dragged the blind sheikh out of prison, and there was a lot of receptors, the Muslim Brotherhood and everything, but they've been funding Hamas since then, and Bibi until, you know, really like minutes ago. And at first people were like, no, that couldn't. Oh, it's true. It's true, right? And Bibi would brag about this on TV, going, isn't this clever? We keep the Palestinians in factions fighting against each other, and that way we'll have none of this peace talk or state nonsense. So tyranny must have an enemy is, I think, a crucial other principle to put on the table. It's addicted to that.
Definitely.
You know, and did you know about that? Well, Bernie Sanders, he's indefatigable, right? He was, but it was his staff who finally took him aside, going, "Hey, Bernie, you're out of integrity here. You know, do this." And so now he is calling for no more money to Israel, and he's indefatigable. Good. So we go, yay. That's a good thing to do. And then back to Israeli society itself. There are great peace activists. There are great things rumbling underneath, right? It's very unstable, right? You had posted something, right? Economically, socially imploding. So just say more about that.
Yeah. Well, and just tonight I was watching, tonight in Tel Aviv, there's a huge rally of Israelis and Palestinians, Arabs, the biggest one yet, calling for a ceasefire, demanding a ceasefire. So, I've been in Israel. I was there for the peace treaty signing between Jordan and Israel in 1994. And I went to Gaza and I actually interviewed a Hamas leader, the Hamas religious leader at the time. And it was a different organization, you know, back then. Wasn't, you know, militant and so crazy as it evolved into because of the situation, But Israel is, you know, reading what's going on, and especially when you read Haaretz and the Times of Israel, there's some great journalists in Israel who are really presenting the truth. And I was, there's a report that's going to come out. Obviously, you've all, you know, heard about the October 7 and how they've done an investigation, and the, you know, the Israelis that were in the kibbutz, you know, who were telling the story of how it was their own people, you know, the IDF that, you know, tanks that, you know, destroyed their homes and killed them. You know, how many, this is all coming out. Like, the, fortunately, you know, they're not just clamping down, and they can't keep people silent, because they do have independent media in Israel, which is really great, that's trying to, you know, give a voice to the rest of the community, because there's a large number of people in Israel who are not Zionist, who are not, you know, hell-bent on destruction, and who want peace. And I know a lot of, I've got a lot of Jewish friends in Australia and around the world, and I love them dearly, and they're level-headed. They haven't been brainwashed. So something that will be coming out tomorrow or on the weekend is a look at the Jewish education system and how these people, how they can have this lack of empathy, this coldness towards the Palestinians. And in their textbooks, there is not a single picture of a Palestinian person as a person. They use caricatures and cartoons, and they dehumanize them, and they bring their children up from the first day of schooling to the end, you know, till they finish high school, believing these stories. They brainwash them into saying the Palestinians want to kill us. They get drummed into them pictures. They see pictures of the Holocaust, and they tell them, all of us are survivors of the Holocaust, and we must never remember this. They breed terror into their own people, which is horrific. You know, what a way to live your life. It's tragic. You know, I remember feeling that way many years ago when I was in Israel, thinking, because, you know, there's a lot of people who, in Israel, who said to me, do you really think we're on the brink of peace? You know, and I was really moved by their comments, because they don't want this. There's a lot of good people who do not want this. They just want to live a normal, peaceful life like the Palestinians. But their leadership is deranged. But it does come back to the people voting those people into power, and they need to vote for other people. So it comes back to us.
It does. It all comes back to us. And Haaretz is brave, right? They're trying to be silenced, and it's a good time to subscribe to Haaretz. If they say, if Israel used a controversial procedure against its citizens, we need to talk about it, the Hannibal Directorate, what it was called, and many, many more things that we want to honor. Yes, the mentor is always and only self-referential, you know, accusing others of what one is doing. There we go. So thank you so much, Daisy Gedeon, for maybe it's two espressos by this point. I hope you can come down off of your espressos and glean some sleep. We will be following you in conversation, and grateful and keeping your and our dreams alive and necessary miracles. May they be so. Thank you very, very much for your work.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Caroline. Thank you so much for having me. I've loved this engagement, really have.
I'm so honored and glad. And thanks always to Kirsten Thomas at KPFA. And this is Caroline Casey. You can also find the entire link to, what am I saying? You can find the link to the South African full document at Patreon, Visionary Activist Show. Thanks again, everybody. And we will reconvene next week. Mwah.